My name is Laura DeLuca, and this is Wednesday, April 11th at 3 p.m., and you're in Mackey Auditorium, hearing session 3304, My Journey as a Lost Boy by Valentino Achekdeng. I'm going to ask right now that you give Valentino the gift of complete presence and also the gift to yourself of turning off your cell phone, and not even just turning it off, but putting it all the way away. I saw some students texting yesterday in the session, not only students, but this is a story you really want to be completely focused on. The other thing I wanted to mention is we're going old school today. We're just going to accept questions on pieces of paper written with pencil. So you don't need your app, you don't need your phone out at all. I have had the blessing of teaching Valentino Achekdeng's book for the last 10 years at the University of Colorado. And if you haven't had a chance to read it, it's a spectacular story of resilience, survival, and just an incredible journey. So we're going to start today with him giving a short overview, some visuals, and we want this to be a very interactive session, not just us talking at you, but you asking questions. And so we'll start off with that. But before we do that, I just want to say a few words about him. I think most of you know about the book he's written, or the book about him that he's co-authored, called What is the What? Very often when I tell people I'm teaching that book, they say, what? And then I say, what is the what? So it's an incredible story of 17,000 young men who fled civil war in Sudan. But instead of just a political history, it really tells you about the history through the lens of Valentino's specific experience. And of the 17,000 who started in South Sudan, only about 10,000, if I'm correct, made it to Kenya. They traveled across the border to Ethiopia. And the hardships that he faced literally are unfathomable. One of the things that he worked on was this incredible story written with Dave Eggers. How many of you have heard Dave Eggers, kind of best-selling author? Dave Eggers also wrote about his own experience. What was the name of his book?
The Heartbreaking Work of a Staggering Genius.
So The Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius, about his own tragedy that he experienced. But Valentino's going to tell you more about how closely they worked. One thing to highlight, though, is the foundation that Valentino started, really focusing on education and giving back to Sudan, war-torn country, now one of the newest countries in the world, South Sudan. And the name of his foundation is the Valentino Achekdeng Foundation. He also has had time to work directly in the political and policy world, not just as an activist, but as a member of the government, State Minister of Education in South Sudan, overseeing 875 schools. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to him. Let's give him a big welcome from Boulder.
Thank you, Laura. It's good to be on the stage with you. You've done a lot of work in Sudan and elsewhere, and I'm privileged to share a stage with you. I also would like to extend my thanks and warm regard to each and every one of you for coming here this evening. This has been a very wonderful week for me, listening to from other speakers and interacting with people, the people of Boulder and Colorado, and visitors who have come to attend the 70th conference on the world affairs. I feel honored to have this stage this evening to share some of my past experience and the experience that I'm going through and things that I'm doing now. The topic for this session is my journey as a lost boy, which actually isn't my only personal journey. It's actually a story. It is a story about young people. It's a story about war. It's the story of displacement. It's a story of migrations. And a story of humankind. In 1983, a civil war broke out in South Sudan. Southern Sudanese had taken up arms against the government of Sudan in Khartoum to fight for self-determination. And as a result, war was extended to the southern region and many communities were targeted. They were targeted because of their ethnic background, they were targeted because of their geographical location, they were targeted because they were supporting or sympathetic. Okay, are some of you having a hard time hearing me? Wow, so you want me to use this? Excellent. Can you hear me now? I speak very soft. If you don't hear me, yell or raise your hand. So by 1987, the conflict had taken tolls on many communities, including my own, and I had to walk across thousands of miles from Northern Bahr Ghazal State, which is located on the northwestern part of the present-day South Sudan, to Ethiopia. I think that journey is what people termed up as the lost boys. I was from my village with a couple of other people, and there are also different people from across the country who have heard that there were refugee camps set up in western Ethiopia and Kenya and Uganda. And so there was a huge migration of people. Towns were targeted, villages were targeted, schools were closed, health issues, there was famine. There was so much that you can imagine about a conflict. And the journey wasn't an easy one for me. You know, at that time in South Sudan, I did not have shoes. I did not have proper clothing. Sometimes no mosquito nets. And you're walking across a vast savanna. You're walking across an unforgiving wilderness. You're crossing rivers. And you are hungry, and you don't have so much. And this was a situation many families and many people had to face. And at that time, there was no media, there was no South Sudan was not accessible. So pretty much the government in Khartoum that was displacing people was also controlling the information to the outside world. So massacres, one after another happened, but after 3.5 months or 4 months, I had walked across 1,000 miles and was in refugee camps in Ethiopia, and for the first time had to live without my family. It was at that time also that I became to know that some of the African cultures are very strong, especially the idea, such as the one in my community where young boys are usually sent to the cattle camps on their own. So sometimes you spend months or weeks away from your family. And in this situation, that played an advantage in my life. So I had to meet other young people and we had to live together. And the Southern Sudanese community, which was very much aware of the fate facing the country, decided to send us to schools. When I say we were sent to schools, the schools weren't actually existing. They were under trees, a school. We had to learn under trees. We have good teachers. In fact, two of my colleagues graduated from University of Colorado here in Boulder a couple of years ago. And we had the benefit of being with educated Southern Sudanese members and having been sent to schools. At time we did not have exercise book. At time there were no pencils. At time there were no textbooks. But we had to make do with what was needed to learn. Ethiopia became the refugee camps where we stayed for a while, for 3 years, and in the fourth year, the Ethiopian regime was overthrown. And we had to leave the country. At that time, we returned back to South Sudan, where the security situation was not good at all. At that time, the rebels movement had captured many towns in the south, and the government in Khartoum had intensified fightings, including aerial bombardments of any moving targets. Any moving target. So any time we were moving somewhere, we were subjects to bombings, we were subjects to ground assault, and we found South Sudan very dangerous. A decision was made and we continued on to northern Kenya in 1992. At that time, I was in the fourth grade and became aware of myself. And that I had to live in a cross-cultural environment with everybody that I would meet, and that there would be no stranger in my life, unless if somebody decided to behave so. So I spent a few years in Kenya, and in 2001, I came to the U.S. At that time, and this is how I'm going to end my statement, over 2.5 million Southern Sudanese had died in the war. Over 4 million Southern Sudanese were internally displaced. Many of them were holed up in Northern Sudan at the camps established by successive regimes that had displaced them. At that time, over 1 million Southern Sudanese had left the country as refugees, including myself. So when I came to America, my flight was on September 11th. And I was stranded in Nairobi. For some reason, I was allowed to come in, and I flew to New York on September 25th, 2001, and came to Atlanta on September 26, 2006. It was a blessing, but that also began a new challenge. As you can imagine, somebody growing up in a place that is not a city, no tarmac road, no towers, no technology. I began my life from scratch. And I approached it with positive attitude, with the goal to integrates here and lives here, and it has been fun and very fortunate. So what I've done so far is I lived here. What is the Word was published, because I did not want to come here and keep quiet and pretend that all was normal back in my country. And I think that's what the book addresses so extensively for your benefit. And I've gone back since then, and I've worked through our charitable organization. We have established schools. We have educated hundreds of children. And we have recently opened a boarding school for girls to address the girl child education. I think I'll just stop here for your briefing, and because I've done this so many times, and sometimes I do not know what people want to know or want to hear. I'll give this back to Laura.
I'm curious about resettling as a resettled refugee coming to a third country, coming to the United States. You face some challenges going to the hospital, getting treatment there. You face some challenges living in Atlanta, starting off with the book, being robbed. Is there anything you can say, lessons that you've learned, or lessons for us as how to welcome refugees in this country?
There are a lot of lessons that I have learned through my own experience and also through experience of other immigrants. First of all, is resettlement is a tremendous idea. It's an idea that helps someone who has been displaced for long to have the opportunity to go to his second homes, a place where they can gain a residential status, work permit, citizenships, and lived a new life, and maybe be able to come back and help in their countries when whatever reason that displaced them is resolved. So in my case, resettlement became an opportunity for me, instead of just living in the refugee camp and staying in Kenya, where and the conflict continuing in my country, it gives me an alternative to come to a country where I will gain a citizenship status, have the opportunity to work, make money, serve, and have a future. That has happened. I am a U.S. citizen. I have worked here, and even the slides you are seeing behind me are a result of having been able to resettle here and then going back to my country to share the benefits of my success. For many immigrants, resettlement also posed many challenges. One example is that when somebody is resettled, let's say, for example, in the city of Colorado, they are often placed in areas where resettlement agency can afford to rent homes for them. Quite often, those neighborhoods are also neighborhoods that are struggling themselves. And when a visitor comes and stay in a place like that, they have not, they quite often don't have a lot of access to what they want, better jobs, better school, being able to afford to buy a car, and they struggle. Many immigrants struggle. On my own, I did not go through that. I actually got a good job. So I work at Best Buy. I work at the Atlanta Decorative Arts Center. And through my exposure, I had a good employer, good company. I was making some money. But when I bought my car, I even had my own challenges. I had two accidents in 30 minutes. Here I had a mentor who assisted me to buy my car, and it was cheaper, a brand new Toyota Corolla. But I had challenge. I thought that was all I need. And then on the first day, two accidents within 30 minutes. I said, hey, this car is going to kill me. But that car would help an immigrant family to drive at a distance and look for a better job and help themselves. Many don't get that. At times, some families come with a huge number of children. The children need to go to school, the parents need to have a job, and you know what it takes to raise children here. People go through that.
One is really about bringing us into that experience of first arriving, what it's like. In particular, we're in Colorado, the city of Boulder, Denver area. What's it like to experience snow? Maybe in Atlanta you didn't have that as much. But just, can you bring the audience into the experience of first arriving in the U.S. and what that was like?
It was. Okay, well, the advantage I had is I didn't have to go through ESL classes or orientations. I pretty much had, I had completed secondary school in Kenya and some college, and it was an advantage. So I could ask questions about what I need, where I want to be, what I want to do. And with that, the infrastructure in Atlanta is big compared to anywhere I have been. Even from driving from the airport to my place on a 6-lane highway, and my immediate concern would be, would any car knock us or what is this? It's too many cars driving on the way. It's something nobody would think is a challenge, but you go through that because you're new, you don't know the area. At times, you struggle with your refrigerator, what you would put in the refrigerator and what doesn't go there. And but again, as I told you before, I was very fortunate because I had a group of volunteers and people that I met immediately. There was a friend of mine called Mary William, who was running the Lost Boys Foundation in Atlanta. Mary is a daughter of Jane Founder. In fact, one of my first visitors was Angelina Jolie in my apartment, whom I didn't know at that time. She was with her boyfriend, a big guy called, is it Bobby Thornton? Something like that? He's a star. And I didn't know who they were, and they were in my apartment. Later on, I came to know them. I'm like, God, these were my early visitors. So I had exposure, and I was assisted. But again, you go through things like getting on the train alone, getting to know your stations, sometimes falling asleep in the train and going past your station. And also, when I looked for my first job, I went to a farmer's market, and I've never applied for a job before, and they asked me for my resume and all of this, and I said, I can walk. So why do you ask me all of those things? And it was good that I didn't get a job there. Because it was very cold. It's the farmer's market and the freezers and all of those. The place I did not want to go to was Fargo in North Dakota. Because of the snow, I had seen some pictures, and some of my friends who went there had spoken to us about snow and weather being a major obstacle. I went to Atlanta and there was no snow there. In fact, my first snow was in Telluride here in 2005. I have a friend in Los Angeles who had a home there, and I used to come to Telluride to do hiking. That's where I had experience with my first snow, and it was amazing.
What is the, can you tell us about the current situation? Is there anything as citizens that we can do to help improve or support what's happening or help make things better?
That's a very good question. The life experience I explained before are not that of my own. In fact, South Sudan had been through long daunting struggle. And by early 1990s, the American government had become aware, fully aware of what was happening in the country, and many Americans and people from Europe started coming to South Sudan, including some of them who were martyrs as journalists and stuff like that. And the American involvement had actually been what led to the present day independence for South Sudan. Southern Sudanese were persecuted because of their religious background, because of their ethnic backgrounds, by successive regimes in Khartoum. But the struggle paid off with an independent of South Sudan in 2011. With that, many challenges came along. The country lacked basic infrastructure. We do not have good road networks, which should have provided access to agricultural land so that we can have an agro-industry. We do not have energy. We do not have electricity. We do not have refineries. So energy security had continued to be a challenge. While the government was made up of many rebel fighters who themselves needed a lot of support. So the making of the state had been challenging, and in 2013, a power struggle among the elites took us back to an unfortunate level of violence and political turmoil. That situation had actually affected the progress and the advantages South Sudan would have gotten. And we have now been going through civil unrest, and it's a situation that still needed America's involvement, starting from individuals and the American government. And the involvement I'm asking for is a neutral involvement where the U.S. government should back up the governments and bring the rebels in to mediate, negotiate, and lay the ground for development of this country. We've gone back to a situation where millions of kids are not in school. Hundreds of families are starving, and the government does not have the capacity to do that. So we're beginning to feel again that America, that helped us gain our independence, is not as involved as it should have been to help this young state, because we are surrounded by every state that needs something from us, including the Sudan where we separated from. You don't help somebody to become independent and then allow him to be taken advantage of. It would be a big mistake. So that's what scores the present day challenges. But as individuals, like we're doing at the foundation and with my teams and with other people, our efforts are meeting the demands of the people and what people need. Does that answer your question?
Okay, so this is also back to your actual journey. There's curiosity, interest. How did you stay positive? How did you handle the hardships without being beaten down? What were you thinking?
The answer to this is simple. If I don't stay positive, who then would be positive? Throughout humanity, people have experience, both positive and challenging experience. What I went through was a result of a historical struggle, of war, of suffering, of famines, of diseases, but I survived. And here I am, and I have a lot of privileges. I have friends, I have people who back me up when I need what I need. So people we laugh with, we joke with. And even as I speak with you, I'm married. I'm a father of four beautiful children, two boys and two girls, and my wife. What happened is a part of history, and a history of war, like it was in the First War and Second World War and all of the other wars. I drew my lesson from the history of Exodus in the Bible. I'm a Christian, I'm a Catholic, and throughout my struggle, I was raised very mindful of the biblical history. Even as I was in the refugee camp, I would always read the Bible and say, damn, I was not alone. So humanity has been through a lot. And it is through experience of people like me that give hopes and courage to others to face the challenges that they go through. So I consider what happened as my past, but I then have the future to live, the present and the future to live.
Thank you. So this is a shift to a question about gender. One of the people in the audience has a question about why were the girls left behind, the so-called lost girls at the time. About 4,000 young men were resettled initially in the 2000s, around the time you were, and there were only 89 girls at that time, later more. Can you say something about that situation between boys and girls?
No girls were left behind intentionally. I was one of the leaders in the camp, and I was a psychosocial worker. I was a reproductive health motivator, and I had participated in a lot of community organizations in Kakuma refugee camps. So when the opportunity to resettle the unaccompanied minors, they were not known as the lost boys. So the lost boy name is a media making. It's actually nothing is known in Sudan like that until we came here. Even me, I was not aware of that thing. But when the opportunity came for the unaccompanied minors to be resettled in the U.S., it was decided that anyone who came to the camp between 1992 and 1999 or 1995, something like that, were the one given the opportunity. And so there were already lists of unaccompanied minors in their groups that were forwarded to the UNHCR. And the UNHCR gave that list to the Joint Voluntary Service that processed resettlement cases. So they would put up names and people will come and do interview. The mistake with that selection now is that culturally, girls were not allowed to live on their own or be mixed with young people as boys were. So girls were adopted by families who were in the camps, and many young girls who had grown were married, most of them at very young age. So when this opportunity came, their names were not in that listing. However, some very young people were allowed to come with their families or whoever they had on their list. That is the opportunity that allowed some of the girls to come. So girls were not left behind intentionally. This is not saying that there were no girls also. Some of them who were there got married. And some who were very young and through maneuvers with humanitarian agencies were given the opportunity to come. Does that answer the question?
Yes.
Thanks.
Okay, so this is a question about surprises. Going back to first arriving in the United States, what surprised you? And one of the audience members wants to know more, if you were giving advice to a new immigrant, a new refugee, what would you say to them?
If I were giving an advice to new immigrants and new refugees, is that they should be courageous enough to interact with their host communities. They should go to social places like churches and not just pray, also meet people and talk to them. At their workplaces, they should ask and investigate what somebody do to go, be it about going to college or changing your jobs or moving to a different areas. Because sometimes somebody would be brought to Denver and they only know Denver. It may take them years to move anywhere. But there are opportunities even within the state of Colorado. So they should be open enough and courageous enough to ask questions and meet with people and interact with people. The Americans I have come to know are the most passionate people, especially when they know how to help or they can be of help to anyone they would. Don't be told that America is a very difficult place and Americans are not good because there are all these wars happening. I've traveled and I've lived in many countries and I can admit to you there are no most passionate people that I have known than the Americans. It's not all Americans, but there are many passionate people and people are willing to help others out of their own. Even the government here have policies that enable people to help others than governments elsewhere.
Can you say something specific about, you said being helped or working with someone who was particularly generous, and then there was also that question about what surprised you, what very specific things surprised you?
What surprised me? There are many surprises. There are many surprises. You know, when you don't know no thing and you don't know people and culture, sometimes you had opportunities. You know, one time I sat next to Matt Damon in New York and I did not know who he was. I sat next to Lance Armstrong and I did not know the guy. And one of my biggest surprises is being invited to speak at the Clinton Global Initiatives. And the person introducing me is President Clinton himself. You know, those things don't happen very easily, right? Yeah. So, you know, things like that, you know, and they are here. Opportunities are available here. Yeah. The development in this country, the infrastructure in this country, the social network, the ability to be able to live wherever you want, if you can and if you want to, is just wonderful. America is a vast country, but if you have a residential status in New York, you can travel across to California without being asked, what is your travel permit? Somewhere, that's not easy. Imagine where in some continents, if you are in the state of Colorado, you will need a visa to go to the neighboring states. You know, the free trades and the free, this access, these privileges are taken for granted, but they are also surprises to people who are new in this country.
It's a question about WASH, which is water, sanitation, and hygiene. The University of Colorado has a big Engineering for Developing Communities program, Engineers Without Borders. I don't know who asked this question, but they wanted to know about WASH, water, sanitation, and hygiene, especially as it relates to how feminine hygiene in schools in South Sudan, hygiene education, anything you can say about that or sanitation?
There are many underlying factors that sometimes breed violence and understanding and displacement in a number of countries. In South Sudan, one of the reasons many young girls do not find it comfortable or sometimes stay in school is that they are required to do a lot of household duties. One of these is if the village is located where there is no water, and particularly during dry season, you find this young woman travel for miles or kilometers to fetch water and come back home. A kid like that would not have the time to go to school because he's expected to go fetch water in the morning. Sometimes, because people depend on rainwater, they have to wait for one rainy season every year to cultivate because there's no water. And sometimes there are droughts. And all of that trickle down even to hygiene issues. People need a lot of water to take shower. They need a lot of water to wash their clothes. They need a lot of water to do a number of things, even to drink. Drinking stagnant water, dirty water, bring diseases. So water is a major problems in a number of the areas where we worked, even including in our schools. At a time you realize you have 500 students in one place and you have only one hand pump borehole. So, yes, water contributes to challenges that people face. If there is enough water, people will cultivate however they want. They can have gardens, they can have vegetables, they can eat balanced diets, and nutritional issues would not affect small children.
Okay. This question is about dreams and goals. There's the saying that you mentioned in Sudan, education is my mother and father. Can you talk a little bit about dreams and goals that you had, and were you able to accomplish them?
I had dreams. One of the dreams was to be able to be of service to others. And I have done that even way before I come to the U.S. I've been a community mobilizer, both at my community and church level and at a regional level in Kenya. I did that through sport, through church, through community service, through forming a small Christian community and group of people to work with. So when I came to the U.S., I also became a big brother in Atlanta, and I provided counseling services to young people. I think the first time I came to Boulder was about 2002 to speak at an advertising agency company here, and I was given that opportunity because I was a member of the Big Brothers and Big Sisters of Metropolitan Atlanta. Through that, when the book came out, we also committed the book revenues into charitable cause, and we started a foundation with that. And the school you see behind me, they are an institution that we established, and they are free, and we're providing educational opportunities to many young people. I was appointed a state minister for education in South Sudan through our work in the educational sector. I'm not a politician. I was just asked to come and help reforms some of the state's educational programs. So I've actually been of service to others, and it is the same thing that I do when I accept to come and speak here, is that I know through story sharing, we benefit from each other's. Somebody learn what to do with the story you hear from another person. And What Is the Water has been a major success. It's the book that actually any Americans who come to South Sudan has always been given to read. And had I decided to keep quiet with that story in the past, it would not have been very helpful. And I am moving on. I am one of the young leaders South Sudan have, and we'll see what the future have for us to develop our country and connect with the people that made it possible for us to be of service to other people.
So you mentioned the book, What is the What? You go into great detail. Dave Eggers goes into great detail about the journey. There's still someone in the audience, even though we've asked a version of that. Describe your journey in detail. Were you with family or friends? How did you keep going? Were there days when you wanted to stop? How many people traveled together? Was it frightening? Where did you get food? That's a lot of questions.
It is, when you talk about this journey, you got to consider the cultural settings of where the journey took place. South Sudan is a place where also communities are very sympathetic and very welcoming of people they do not know or strangers, and that actually helped us through our journey. So welcomes in hundreds, sometimes in fewer numbers, and where you settled, the chief of the area or the rich man of the area or the spiritual leader of the area would welcome you and then mobilize the community to provide you with food, water, and you're shown where you are. I remember one time we come to a village that had nothing, but they had just hunted an elephant somewhere at a distance, and there was a water pond there. It was in March, and they said, "We don't have plenty, but we can show you where there is an elephant, and you guys can eat from the elephant's meat." We did that. We have to eat elephant. You know, so those generosities were available, and they made it possible for us to leave from one place to another. Sometimes somebody would volunteer to take you to a direction where you will not get in trouble. Those things happen. Yeah. So there we met a lot of generosity as well as hardships at the same time. But the best way I can describe this journey in detail is the book. Because I'm talking about the details of 30 years ago. You know, sometimes it's very difficult to go back to vivid memories and bring them up.
Okay, so this is a shift to more about causes of the war in Sudan, and particularly oil. We haven't mentioned oil. There was a religious dimension you mentioned. Is oil a resource curse, or can it be a resource cure? Can you talk a little bit more about the role of oil in the conflicts?
I do not believe in the idea that oil is a resource curse. It's like any other resource anyway. We make it a resource curse. Because where there is oil, well, people see abundance, people see opportunities, and different people comes in. And what I've learned of late, when there has been a conflict in an oil-producing country, the conflict does not originate from the owners of the oil themselves. It is brought to them. The southern Sudanese I have come to know are not even aware about the oil's abundance and the money and all of that. You know, it's a country that has a long way to go. But I think for some reason the leaderships and whoever interact with them make the oil a curse. Saying that oil is a curse to me is similar to saying that the rivers we have, the mountain we have, the wilderness we have, all the good things that nature has given us should be a curse, right? Why? And of course, unfortunately, in South Sudan, when South Sudan separated from Sudan, it went away with all of the oil revenues. And even the leadership is very innocent about how to take care of their own business. As I speak today, the oil tariff they have negotiated with Sudan makes them give more money to Sudan than they get themselves, who own the oil. But this decision was made by some naive leader. He didn't know what he was, but the people who were helping him did not help him negotiate a better deal for the oil tariff. I can talk a lot, but I don't think oil is a curse. It's sometimes when someone is innocent, they are taken advantage of. And it is who he or she who take advantage of them that make their resource a curse to them.
So this is a question about public institutions and refugees and immigrants resettling here, settling here. How can public institutions play a positive role? What role can they play? In particular, libraries. Is there a role for these institutions in helping new refugees and immigrants? Or what role?
Yes, there are roles. We are communities, and when there are members of communities that do not have certain privileges and have advantages, we're supposed to reach out to them and help them. There might be people who are here and someone might be going to school and they don't know how to access the library. Or there is a bookstore that has a book that they no longer want to sell, and they don't know somebody is in need of them. So what we need to do for this institution to help is more awareness, where someone who knows a bookstore might give something, goes there. Mm. And then if they know where a community in need is, they go there. At our own level, we should have days of services where we go out and look out for members of our community who needs what we have that we may not know. I was looking at my Facebook yesterday and some apps came up and people are selling iPhones. Somebody is selling an iPhone 5 for $20. Somebody is selling a camera for small amount of money, and is on Facebook. If somebody doesn't know how to utilize those services, and you are here, maybe you are a student, and you know that you can locate those people, those communities, and help them. Maybe have an iPhone by paying a small amount of money, and it's a used iPhone, or have a computer, and they don't pay as much as they would when they buy a brand new computer, or have somebody give them their devices. Could involve beds, mattresses, things that we don't want to use. But again, not everybody should be doing that. There should be somebody knowing that, coming to someone and say, there are these opportunities here, or you have this thing that can help somebody. I'm a social worker, so I might tell you things you don't want to hear.
Yes. So what was it like to work with Dave Eggers, and why the title, What is the What?
Dave is a very humble person. He's actually, the reason we worked well is that we didn't consider this project something else than just two friends working for a common goal, to get a story that they should share with others. We went to Sudan together at times when we were not allowed to go to South Sudan. And you know, it took us a very long time to come up with this material. At times we act as if nothing was happening. So we started in late 2002 and the book was published on October 25th, 2006. So we took trips to a number of places, Ethiopia, South Sudan, Kenya, and elsewhere.
How did you first meet him?
I was introduced to him by a friend of mine, Mary Williams. Mm-hmm. And Mary Williams had come to know me and know my ideas. And actually, I had many other writers interested in working with me. But I was not certain about the people I was meeting. Some I do not know and what I was. So with Dave, we actually started from a friendship point of view. And when we met in my place in Atlanta, I came to his wedding, my first American wedding. I remember I have never known of the idea where the bride greets everyone. And I'm like, this is too much work for her. So we started at that point and we became a family. We came to know each other's. And it's not easy working with him because I would do something and then it is distorted altogether. And I'm like, no, this is not how I want to tell this story. Mm. But then he's like, but the reader will not get it the way you want. So sometimes when you work with an author and you're not an author, you know, you go through some techniques, some writing. Like when we use the incident in Atlanta as the platform to tell the story, right? For me, it's like a small thing. I was mocked and it is over, you know. But it has the meaning in my story, you know. And it became something people said, you were mocked in Atlanta. How dare that happen in America? And I said, tough things happen somewhere too. And do you know how many people get mocked in America? I was not the only one. In fact, I survived it, right? So these things are normal. They happen. So working with Dave was both fun, challenging, exciting, and we got the materials out.
And the title, I also know from teaching this
if you
book.
Put everything I have said together, we still even have more words to us. Right? Around us in the book, the title doesn't have a specific meaning. In my personal way, it's like, why the war and what was it for? Why do many people have to die? You know, but some of it were naive questions that I would ask when I was young. Mm-hmm. I would not ask them in the same way today.
Mm-hmm. So in that answer, you touched on issues of family, becoming close to David's family, Dave Eggers. There have been some questions about families. I know some families were reunited with refugees coming here. Can you say anything about family, your own family?
My family is there. My dad, my mother are there. My dad is married to many wives, and with many children, with many siblings. It's a big family. It's actually one of the reasons I've gone back and spent a lot of times there is to be able to interact with the family too. I have become an inspiration to many of my younger siblings and even the elderly ones. So my mom and my dad are there. We left it out from the book as a suspense. You will maybe read about it and other times. I told you before, I am married. I'm not going to marry many wives like my daughter. but yeah, my family is there.
When you go back to Sudan, what do they notice about you after living in the U.S. now since 2001? Is your language the same? Do you speak Dinka language? Or?
Yeah.
Does it sound the same?
I do not only speak Dinka, I write Dinka.
Arabic?
So I told you I am a Catholic, and when we were taught catechism, you actually are taught in your native language. So I became to know the Dinka literature. Part of it is what has actually enriched what is the word, because I'm telling things from my cultural perspective. Through storytelling, through chronological accounts of events. So yeah, I speak my native language and I speak it very well. I do not speak it. I speak Swahili. I speak other languages. I've had advantages of traveling from one geographical area to another. So I speak more than one language. Mm-hmm. On languages based, no problem. Socially, I have come to know a lot. So I think in a diverse terms. So sometimes when I go home to my people, you see the people are not aware of other people elsewhere. Somebody doesn't know even how far it takes me to fly back to the village. And somebody would say, why can't you stay here forever? And I'm like, if I stay here, I will not be able to do the things I'm doing. So it's actually, the advantage I have is that I have borrowed from other cultures. And with that, I'm able to discard what doesn't work where I am, that work somewhere. So I'm fluent in my native language. I interact with people very well. I know a lot, hundreds of other people. There's no single city I will go to in South Sudan without somebody I know.
So this is a question about technology. How could technology help the refugee crisis, play a role, technology?
Are you talking about refugees that have come here? Or refugees that are in the refugee camps, because technology is helping in a number of ways. If you're talking about refugees who are in the refugee camps in countries where there is electricity, I think them having access to internet, sometime having access to money, pesa, or what do you call it mobile money, you know, helped in where somebody can send something far away to someone in another location. It also helped with doing research online, reading materials online, doing text, exchanging literary materials online. So technology helped in those sort of ways. And even also in the information sharings. There are people locked up somewhere with no access to simple information that can help them. You know, there was a time I was sick and I did not know what it was. So I went online and I Googled. I just typed in how I was feeling. And he said, if you have this pain, you can ask this, you can consult this. And I was able to get the doctor I want because I knew what I was suffering. Those are things you can get in through technology.
So this is something I'm supposed to read as the moderator, and I'll just take a moment while we're waiting for more questions to quickly mention that the CWA 70th crowdfunding campaign is happening, and to celebrate CWA's 70th year, we have set a goal to raise $70,000. We're a quarter of the way. CWA is a quarter of the way to the goal. And we would appreciate your support. I know your cell phones and mobiles are away right now. But when you pull them back out, you can give by selecting the donate button on your app or visiting the CWA website. So we're still waiting for more questions. Really enjoying this interactive format. Do we have more questions from the audience? Anything about your foundation?
Well, if you, I don't know if you have been able to see our website, is www.vadfoundation.org. And I also would like to introduce two very wonderful young women who are the lifeline of our foundation, our development director, Kira Sibet. Could you stand up? People see you. They're shy. They don't like being seen. She's a big force behind our success. We also have Kara Walden. She's our program manager. If there is anything I have not stated very clearly, you could talk to them. They know more than I do.
Related to global development, international development, if you could talk about how best practices for global development, for international development, what kinds of things need to happen You mentioned on another panel the importance of infrastructure. Is there anything else that you would say in terms of collaboration, an organization like yours, how to get things done most effectively?
On that ground,
partnerships.
Or in that front, I've actually realized that so much money goes into humanitarian support. Let's say, for example, the United States have spent $11 billion in South Sudan during the last maybe decade, from 2005 up to now. They're building the capacity and a number of other things. But if you looked at that amount of money and what it should have been done for, you would say if part of that money had gone into development aid instead of humanitarian interventions, and with that money you could have helped build roads, bridges, electricity, and develop an agro industry, I think you would have a country that have a market, that have commodities, that is utilizing their agricultural land because there is excess, and they may even have been able to do import and export with the U.S. But I think sometime we wait until there is a political or economic crisis and then we spend money on humanitarian work. That means that money ends when conflicts ends, but then you have nothing to show with it because it was spent on emergency. I think something needs to be thought out about helping, identifying and helping states that do not have the infrastructure required to develop a local market that is sustainable, to help them create jobs, to help them employ their young population, to help them provide meaningful educational programs, including technical education. You know, I've seen that thing is missing. Like, let's say, for example, the region of East Africa is the vast region with maybe nearly 500 million population. Ethiopia has over 90 million, Kenya has over 50 million, Uganda have over 20 million, Rwanda have a few million, South Sudan, Djibouti, Somalia, but they don't have a regional markets. And no investment goes there. If they have a market and people have jobs, people who have things to do would not be so mindful of being trained as soldiers to go and fight wars, they don't know. But because we have a young population that don't know what to do, sometimes they become subjects to dictators who can come back and say, we are this tribe, we are this ethnic community, we must pick up arms, we must overthrow the government of that ethnicity. And then we see cycles of political violence, one after another, because so much of the population is idle. That's one.
You have more?
You can go ahead.
So moving from more of the political policy level to more personal questions from the audience about the refugee camps themselves, and particularly one of the questions is, was there happiness and comfort while living in the refugee camps? Was Ethiopia or Kenya better? So happiness, I remember students being surprised, that section that you wrote about the girls of Penedo and kind of teenage crushes, those kinds of things. Is there anything you would say about happiness in the camps, and then also what it was like to be reunited with your family?
You see, camps are not violent places. And that is why they become areas where displaced people are sent to. So take, for example, Kakuma Refugee Camps was established in August 1992. It means people were born there, people got married there, and families were started there. Some people went to school there. Some people who are medical doctors, engineers and whatever were born there. So, and there are different cultures and life is lived as normal as it can be lived somewhere. It's just that somebody is displaced. And even in some cases, living in displaced camp is sometimes better than even someone living in their own areas, in that region. So camps were not violent. You just miss your home. That's what I noticed in the camp. I went to school there. I was a young boy in primary school. You have young girls you interact with. You have teachers. All those things that happen in high school or elementary school. And there are even technical schools in the camps. So Kakuma camps was a different situation. Camps are only difficult when they are newly established and people have just been displaced or they have just left their homes. But when they settled and they come to agree with themselves that going home isn't going to happen sooner, but I have to live lives anyway. So camps are not violent place. Okay. Unless if they are situated in a conflict zone. But those ones, you don't call them refugee camps. You call them internally displaced people's camps. Mm-hmm. Like you could have it in Syria, you could have it somewhere in Iraq. When the conflict is going on and civilians are displaced, they are given a temporal place to stay. But when they leave their country, they live in the camps. Some countries has a policy, like in Uganda, refugees are not actually confined in the camps. They are given plots to own and they can cultivate there. I don't know how the Ugandan government came up with this wonderful idea. Mm. And it is working in northern Uganda. In Kenya, refugees have camps that the government have allocated and they stay there and they can leave camps with the permission to go to the rest of the country and return. If somebody is asking about me being happy, I was a very happy young man in the camp.
Okay.
Played basketball, volleyball. I was one of the best. And I enjoyed my time. I actually never leave regretting constantly what happened. Even up to today, I do not regret what I went through. I take it as a part of a history. I don't know, it's very difficult to tell people here, but imagine if you were part of the Jewish who were persecuted in Germany. See, at a certain level, you've had to accept that what happened, happened. It's a part of human struggle. But you cannot leave regretting it, and you also do not expect to be seen in terms of that. Mm-hmm. Because we overcome things. We sometimes have things we go through that could not even be about conflict, but are social thing. We have even sometimes boyfriend, girlfriend breaks up. Mm-hmm. Families breaks up. Mm-hmm. Friends breaks up. But we should not allow them to determine how we live our future.
So we have just a few more minutes, and we aren't going to get through absolutely every one of the questions, but we're here afterwards and would love to talk to you. So I am going to ask a few of the questions. One, does the foundation hire recent graduates? Would love to contribute. So.
We don't hire, but we love volunteers. We do not have the capacity to hire. Something that we have done in the past, and we're going to do it again also, is we used to have volunteers who would pay their own tickets and come to Sudan and help teach, help and work with us. But what we have now is we have volunteers, like in Boulder, if there's a group of people that want to put themselves up, and they could be our focal point here. They can organize.
Are you based in
function for
Atlanta?
Us. We are in San Francisco.
San Francisco now, okay.
and so they could organize things for us. We would love to have a team in Boulder. And if students are here and they want to form that for the University of Colorado in Boulder, we would be very open up to that idea. It's the best way to network. It's the best way to help each other. It's the best way to reach out to those who may not be in the location we are, but are within our reach. That is the advantage technology can do with us.
One question from a student. As a black student, too often, I'm going to shorten this a little bit so we can get it completed. As a black student, I often am mansplained by white students, females as well, on how Africa is bad or sad because of colonialism, colonizations. Is this attitude shared by 20-year-olds in Sudan?
Africa unfortunately suffered from decades of stigmatizations, stereotypes, but I still think that the colonial legacy should not be given a room to deprive Africa of what it deserves. In some anthropological studies, Africa is the cradle homes for mankind. In some anthropological studies, we have very strong cultures in Africa. It's the most diverse continent, rich with natural resources, wildlife, and humans too. Do not let anything like that undermine your ability to live and share experience with people. Sometimes we get that. Even sometimes personally, the story of the lost boy seemed to overcloud everything I'm capable of, but that is not the case. There is a lot in Africa, and there had been, and there's still more to discover, to experiment, to share. It's one of the best continents I have known. Anytime I fly into Africa, when I go to Kenya, I see great migrations. When I go to Tanzania, Mount Kilimanjaro, Rwanda, Uganda, Lake Victoria, Ethiopia, all of this, there's nothing wrong with Africa. We should actually start migrating there and fix things and build it. Yeah.
Okay.
So when somebody tells you about Africa, you should laugh and be happy and tell them what you know about Africa is not all that there is in Africa. Tell them what is in Africa, too, that they should know.
So as we transition to the end of the session, very simple question, as people have had their cell phones away. Mobile phones, technology, what age were you when you first interacted with them? Can you say anything about your first experiences with a mobile or cell phone?
My first cell phone was in 2002. And I didn't do a lot of it except texting and calling. I don't think there was a lot of smartphones at that time either. And even my first phone calls, international phone call, was also at that time. But it has changed a lot, right? I think in 2002, that is an era when there is just an overwhelming technological expansion. Something is developed next. And I've had fun with it, just like other people. I think we shared in this cell phone technology and computer technology. My first computer was when I was in the CAM. If you read what is the what, you will realize that I was working for a Japanese organization called Wakishai. And I was the project deputy project manager, and I had an IBM computer, and we would make long-distance phone calls using Thuraya. I did not know so much, but I was trained.
Wonderful. So what a wonderful session. Thank you for sharing deeply of yourself. And it's really exciting to see that you've translated these experiences into policy, into humanitarian outreach yourself as someone who knows Sudan extremely well. We welcome you as an audience to come up and ask us questions, but we're officially at time now. I hope